Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England, and I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. A few weeks ago, it was UK Games Expo, the largest UK tabletop games convention, and this year it was bigger than ever. Me and resident rules lawyer, Judge Blythe, took a trip down to Birmingham to cover the complete weekend. And in this episode, we relate some of the tales to give you a bit of a flavour of the games that we played, our tour of the trade hall, and some of the thoughts and discussions that we had with people that we met along the way. Like last year, part of the experience was done in conjunction with ShadowCon. These were games that were held off-site in a secret location, an obscure, outward-bound Airbnb detention centre, hidden on a dual carriageway somewhere in Birmingham. That event was organised by Steve from All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes podcast, and I've recently appeared on a panel where we discussed settings that were difficult to play. You know, the ones where, despite your best efforts, you can't quite bring yourself to be a games master for them because they're too humorous, too fascist, too violent, too soon. I found it a really compelling and interesting discussion that helped me to work my way through some of the games that I find difficult to games master and play. One of the topics that we discussed was the nature of irony. It's a precondition of drama, but hard to achieve in a tabletop role-playing game. It's not authored. The events in the game are like an unfolding present, where the players have agency in the moment. And how can you create objective distance so that there's another layer of understanding of what's really going on in the scenario? As you know, in this podcast, we like to explore different games and how they interact with popular culture and other experiences. I was therefore delighted to get a chance to speak to Lawrence Phillips of Hardy Roach Games to talk about his game called Phantasma del Giallo. The Phantom of the Yellow, a role-playing game inspired by the giallo film genre. These are Italian pulp thrillers which originated from the yellow colours of the mystery paperback books. Then they became a popular film genre during the early 1960s and reached a commercial peak in the 1970s, with examples from directors like Mario Bava and Dario Argento. I fell down a rabbit hole of watching these films and being captivated by them back in the 90s and early 2000s. I think I liked the idea of them more than the actual films themselves, with their lurid colours, weird plots, mysterious characters, vivid horror, and brilliant posters, which have influenced many films that have followed. Lawrence's tried to capture the essence of these films and other related fiction and try to put them in within a gaming context in a manner that tries to have that ironic distance that I didn't think was possible in role-playing games. Anyway, listen to the interview and you'll find out more. I always worry a little bit with these podcasts where we give reports from conventions. It's a bit like us inviting you round to our house to see a slideshow of our all-inclusive trip to Madeira. I'm sure you'll forgive us a bit of indulgence. Make yourself a brew, keep hydrated, have a hobnob, press the pause button now and again, and I'll be back at the end with some parish notices. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open box!
Welcome to Open Box, the Zoom of role-playing rambling. And I have game designer and the publisher, Hardy Roach Games, Lawrence Phillips. Hello there, Lawrence.
Hello there.
So you're based in the UK, aren't you?
Yes, indeed. I'm from sunny Hammersmith in London. I mean, originally from the West Country, but I live here now.
Have you got a role-playing club there? Who do you play with?
there's a London-based RPG club that kind of has branches all over the place, and there is one in Hammersmith. I've only been a couple of times, so I mostly end up like hosting games at my house with friends. But I do sometimes play over in East London at the Arcanist Tavern. Some people from, sometimes I play with the Raspy Raven, sometimes do events in London.
With friends, is it a regular group that you have? A
couple of regular games, just kind of very loose, whatever we fancy playing kind of group, where mostly we've been playtesting for the last like year. And then I've got like a regular Trail of Cthulhu group as well. And then I'll just sometimes just do like one and two shots, you know, at places. So it's you know, it's a pretty rich RPG scene in London, really. Like there's a lot of, there's always a lot of events going on, you know, like these kind of mini cons, I guess they sometimes called, where, you know, they just rent out a pub or whatever.
How did you get into role-playing? Just take us back to how you got into the games. What games were you playing back then?
Sure. So I got into RPGs when I was like 12 or 13, around that. At school, I had a group of mates, and they also were like talking about like D&D and Star Wars RPG and stuff. My first proper game was of Star Wars Saga Edition, which was like a D20 hack of Star Wars. It was decent. And the first game I ended up running was the next one. I ran a Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay Second Ed game. And that's honestly still one of my favorite systems, even though it's not necessarily a whole lot. Like, I don't play that many games like that. But I really, like these days, mostly because in the circles I move in, they're just not as common, although they aren't necessarily my favorite type as a genre. But I have a lot of fondness for that game, and especially like it's got a kind of a grittiness to it, like a groundedness to it, that I think other games that have been trying much harder to achieve that haven't managed. Went to university, ended up getting very involved in the role playing game society there, ended up running the tabletop portion of the RPG Society for several years, along with Minerva McDander, who is also professional in TTRPGs these days and a good friend of mine. Gave me my first break in TTRPG writing when I wrote for her game Legacy.
So you've designed a game that you're about to launch. What's that called?
Il Fantasma del Giallo, which is kind of a horror / thriller kind of neo-noir game inspired by, well, giallo films, which is like a Italian genre of kind of neo-noir thrillers and horror films, and also inspired by like metatextualist and magical realist media like The Twilight Zone and Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire, Funny Games, that kind of thing. If you don't know about giallo, like, don't worry, I wrote it for you. Like, I don't expect anyone else to be like a fan of hyper specific, you know, European film genres. It's designed so that you can explore the themes and ideas of this genre without needing to know anything about it, you know. And it's been a very gratifying thing in playtesting, is that has worked really well. Like, I've been playtesting it with people who have never seen these films quite a lot, and it's going better than I hoped.
We make a big deal out of the fact that games are never in a vacuum, either. They're part of culture, and they engage with culture. So, like you say, particularly niche genre from Italian film history. So, what appealed to you about the giallo movies?
I discovered them when I was a teenager, and I was really into the then nascent brand of like kind of online review shows that were kind of not very deep. They were quite superficial. They were more like beat by beat breakdown summaries of a film with jokes thrown in, right? Like people like, you know, Nostalgia Critic and The Cinema Snob and stuff like that. And The Cinema Snob was the one who introduced me to the genre by talking about, I think it was like the first one he taught, the one I remember him talking about. It's an interesting one. It's quite bad. It's like really, really exploitative. And I mean that in like the filmic sense, rather like, I don't know how people are treated on set or whatever, but like it's very much an exploitation film. It's in that kind of genre. It's called Giallo Evidenzia, I think. I had a growing fascination with kind of horror and thriller and kind of this kind of boundary pushing media And I ended up like actually tracking, like, and I ended up collecting films, especially kind of very niche and weird and often very bad films. Like, I used to go down to the market in where I went to uni every week, and like there'd always be like people selling these really bizarre films, like on really bad quality DVDs, right? And I had quite a collection. And then I saw some ones that were actually like really quite good. You know, like the works, like Dario Argento is probably like the pinnacle of the genre of, you know, Lucio Fulci and Mario Bava and Umberto Lenzi. And like, they definitely had some elements that don't, you wouldn't see them in modern films, or at least you wouldn't see them as kind of uncritically deployed as they were in the 70s, right? But like, in their own weird, nihilistic, violent, exploitative way, there's actually like a really interesting core to these films of like society and trauma and experience and how that kind of makes and breaks us. And it's something that breaks it away from like slasher films that came afterwards that were American, which are really very like moralizing. They're very like, you know, a big evil guy comes along and he's pure evil. Like even Michael Myers, who's in an insane asylum the start of Halloween, or breaks out of it, I should say, at the start of Halloween, is like described explicitly as just evil, right? In his soul, he's just pure evil. Giallo doesn't do that. It's more like we're all just clay and society is corrupt and horrible and sleazy, and so are we. And some of us have horrible, horrible things happen to us. We see our family members murdered, or, you know, we're tortured as kids or as adults. And it breaks something in us, right? And it obviously, like in real life, mentally ill people don't typically go around in black coats and hats killing people. It functions as like a metaphor for the way that we can be jarred into acts that are anti-societal, like anti-social, by how we're treated and the things we experience. And I think that's interesting. I think people don't talk about that in like, when they talk about these films necessarily, right? They just talk about how violent they are and how brutal they are. And it's
like, from my experience of watching The Killers, really non-specific, because like you say, it isn't a particular character. If anything, it's like a mysterious entity, isn't it, that appears and sometimes doesn't get resolved.
I think that's absolutely true. And that's part of like, in my game, this idea of the killer, it's less like it's going to be one of the characters, or at least one of the player characters, or at least one of the people that they know if they're dead, right? Until the killer is unmasked, they are everyone and they are no one in a very like real sense. Like you can't actually unmask them until it's time in the narrative for the waveform to collapse and for them to stop being. Like I was thinking a lot about the film Blood and Black Lace, which is very much like the kind of giallo, right? It's like it's got all of the hallmarks that would become like very common. And there's a bit in that film where the guy's mask gets ripped off, and for like two frames you can see his face, and he's neither of the people who are eventually revealed to later be under the mask, right? And that was obviously because like it's a standard. I think it might, like, I know Argento did this, it might even be like the director, like Argento stood in for the killer in Bird of the Crystal Plumage and Deep Red, right? But like that's in literal terms, that's what it is. But like this is like really interesting because he's not ready to be someone yet. So he's no one. He's just a guy who isn't in this film. He's so not appearing in this film because he's not ready to appear yet. There's meat on that. Like in a lot of horror games or whatever, and this isn't the floor, it's just like what they are. You are kind of you're entered into the reality of the film, right? So you're not engaging with the narrative like you know it's a horror film. You're just in this parallel dimension that happens to have all the same rules as a horror film. But in this game, you are cognizant, both as a player and as a character, that you're in a film, or at least part of you is, because the actor who you play is also playing a character, and they are both of these people, right? And like I did this for a few reasons. Like part of it was depersonalization, because I wanted people to be more comfortable with having their characters do horrible stuff, with having their characters kill people, with being killed themselves, with kind of actively working against their own interests as a character. And I also wanted to like a lot of genre games don't work as well at tables where people aren't familiar with the genre. So I was like, well, if I have it operate on this metatextual level, they don't need to, because the systems I'm building are kind of pushing them. They have to engage with the genre in an extra textual sense.
So it's interesting hearing you talk about that framing of the fiction and setting it within the fiction. Mm-hmm. We've been talking recently about how some settings are difficult to deal with and difficult to handle. The way that you framed it, you've kind of allowed that ironic distance for the players by just stepping them out of it and putting them in a fiction.
So the premise of the game is that your characters are kind of down on the luck or disgraced actors with dark pasts. Now, they probably have, and you know, it depends on your table, but they probably haven't done something as horrible as the characters that they'll end up playing do. But they've definitely made mistakes, and they might have been understandable mistakes, but those mistakes have led them to become ostracized from society, right? And from the mainstream career. But they've ended up in this weird town. The main thing of note in the town is a film studio, and it's making films. And you've signed a contract to be in every single one of them, and they're just going to keep making them, just over and over and over, more and more and more. And you can't remember you can't remember all the details of your life. You've got the broad strokes, but you can't remember specifics, right? It just shapes and colors and emotions. And then you go to shoot the first film, and suddenly you're not on set anymore. You're in the place, you're at the thing, right? And you're not just you're the actor anymore, you're also the character you're playing in the film, and they're both in your head at the same time. You know, you can feel their wants and desires, but you're also aware, you know, there's this conflicting thing. You play through the film, and then, you know, various things happen. Nobody knows who the killer is or where it's going. All the scenes and the mystery is built collaboratively. As you go from scene to scene, you're in this dimension of narrative. It's not a physical place, really. Like, things are only true if they're narratively important for them to be true, and they only remain true for as long as it's narratively important for them to remain true. So, like, reality is malleable, and you can shift reality by changing the plot, right? And, you know, each actor has, like, a playbook where they have, like, a typecasting, like a kind of role they usually play, like the crook is, like, criminal types, and the don is, like, powerful people, and, you know, the visionary is, like, iconoclasts and radicals and artists. And you each have a different way of influence. You have, like, unique ways of influencing reality. Like, the crook has, like, an ability where he can kind of reach under a desk and pull out and find a gun that's taped there, or like behind a toilet tank, say, or a wardrobe or whatever. You know, anyway, you build up these truths, which are like these hard kind of, they're almost like crystallized narrative, right? Like, you can't change them like you can change other things. There's a core to them. You can maybe shift the context around them, but they're hard nuggets. And then when you finish the film, you awaken into reality again, remembering, you know, you're on set, the director yells cut, that's a wrap, folks, you're back there again. And you can remember all the trauma that you just went through. You built it up, and you can use the truths that you've gathered to unlock memories about your life before you got here. And they might not be exactly the same, but they're like jumping off points, right? So, like, if you uncovered a truth, there was a truth held against you that you were dealing drugs or whatever. Maybe you had like a drug addiction at some point or something like that, right? And then you have like a layer of narrative in the real world where you can kind of try and find out what's going on, like why you're trapped here, why you can't seem to leave. And as you uncover more memories about what you did to kind of deserve to be here, you know, the more you can kind of advance the sort of what's really going on. And I'm going to have as well a lot of suggestions for what could really be going on, because I don't want to prescribe that too much. Yeah. I want people to get creative with it.
So you mentioned that you've got playbooks and they've got these elements in that. Mm-hmm. So what other things are there mechanically to help you resolve all this and bring it together?
On like a moment-to-moment level for like, you know, like conflicts, there's like a conflict resolution system. So the whole game uses playing cards as its resolution. And each player and the GM, the director, has their own deck, right? Their unique deck that's marked to make, or like a different color of. When in a system that is like the jumping off point for this idea was Dogs in the Vineyard, which is one of my favorite games from a design perspective. I love the way that it kind of takes gambling, like mechanics that feel like poker hands, and kind of turns them into dice, right? And in a really engaging back, and I love that back and forth that it has. And I was like, I love that. I want two things to be different about it, though, in a few things. First is I want cards, because I like cards, even though they're a nightmare to design around. Second thing is Dogs in the Vineyard is like push and pull, and like you lose ground and gain ground narratively and like physically, right? Like you take damage as like it goes on. I want it to be all or nothing, because I like this idea of trying to replicate that moment in the Giallo film where a character who has gone largely unscathed apart from like arguing with people and like, you know, experiencing scary things, suddenly gets stabbed, right? Like I want that all or nothing moment. So it's this trick-taking system where you take it in turns to play bids that advance like a bit of narrative, and like a losing bid will mean that you have to then kind of describe how the conflict's not going your way, and a winning bid means you have to describe how it is going your way. And then the winner of like a bidding round can then decide whether to just continue the conflict as it's going, but without introducing any new cards or raising the stakes, making things more dangerous and thus like more traumatic by kind of escalating the conflict to something else and getting new cards, or just giving up. And whoever gives up takes every bid that's been played, whether it's been played by you or the other person, and they take it as trauma, which is like the closest thing that game has to damage. It's not so much like being physically injured as it is like a, you know, just like a cumulative thing of physical injury and mental damage and emotional damage and pressure, narrative pressure, right? From round to round, you accumulate like a little bit of trauma as well, just to make sure it's not completely all or nothing. From scene to scene, you have this process called scene drafting, where the GM kind of gives you a few cards and you compare them to a table that gives you like a load of different, like, I think it, what would it be, like 40 different story prompts, and they're quite general but with enough kind of textual meat that, you know, it guides you in a good direction. And then like the person who drafted the scene can kind of come up with a premise for that scene that people can collaborate on and like decide who's going to be in it, and then people can gate crash scenes. The director is kind of less the sort of authority figure and more like a mediator, right? Like the head writer on like a table of writers. Set the pace, and they make sure everything's on track and everything makes as much sense as you can expect it to in this genre. And like they can make sure that like it's not like three people arguing over what color the curtains are for like 20 minutes, right? They can be like, right, like I'm mediating here, like this is the color they are, let's move on, right? So they kind of decide when to like cut a scene and start a new scene, but like everything within the scene is very in player's control. And like directors are encouraged to, if they're like asked a question about like, I don't know, what does the room look like? Who's standing where? Like, is this character here? You know, they just return the question. Like, well, I think there's something, like the other thing is I'm very much encouraging players to engage with their storytelling, like not through their own eyes as a character, but like through the camera's eyes. So instead of saying like, I walk into the room, they say like, oh, well, the camera is like in the room already, and the door opens and my character walks in, right? Like, and even that like little change, once people get into that mindset, it actually really changes how they talk about narrative and how they talk about like how a scene develops, and they're more willing to kind of put themselves on a back foot or like lose an advantage, because like it's just, that's just good storytelling, right? They're thinking about it from that perspective.
Like you, I kind of fell down a Giallo rabbit hole back in the 90s and with a friend. And I always had the view that I liked the aesthetic of the posters and the feel of them more than I actually enjoyed the films.
I'll show you, actually. I mean, if you look at the art, like the art and on the Kickstarter and stuff like that, is very much inspired by Giallo posters. And literally, like the two things that drove the whole aesthetic, like the art is mine. I'm doing the art, I'm doing the layout, I'm doing everything. It's a lot. But the thing driving like the style was a combination of the Jalo posters and also the opening credits of Blood and Black Lace, which has these like shots where characters are standing in the dark with these really strong colored lights, right? And that's like, I mean, like it's probably, I mean, I guess like if it's your taste, if you ended up enjoying the posters more than the films. And I love both, you know, I do love the posters. Absolutely. I actually pondered, like I've got three volumes with a fourth on the way of these. You can't see this if you're listening, but I'm showing a volume of the Giallo movie posters by Scary Images, I think. It's called Creepy Images, this company. But yeah, there's four volumes of this and I recommend them. They're beautiful.
I'm intrigued by these role-playing games that are pushing players into uncomfortable areas and exploring narrative in different ways.
You know, I can't speak for you, but like a lot of people in RPGs, like I'm of a progressive mindset, I'm of a left-wing mindset. I believe very strongly in like, you know, not kind of perpetuating racism and ableism and misogyny. And boy, do Giallo films have a lot of those. But the thing about it is, I'm also of the belief that there can be value in negativity, in negative experiences, right? I don't think something has to be affirming to be constructive. And I'm not saying that. That's not like a personal judgment. I don't care really what people personally want to engage with in terms of art. But like, I think there's value in negativity, in negative experiences, and in darkness. And I think there's ways as well that you can draw out value from genres that are really riven with like, what you say, problematic stuff. Without, you don't need to bring that with you. The horrible stuff. You don't have to replicate that bit unless you want to kind of deconstruct it, which is valid, right? Like I think there's like, I think it's just being aware of it. And like something I loved Lovecraft-esque, and it had like really detailed stuff talking about like racism in like Lovecraftian mythos stuff, and I think that's really valuable. And like I'm going to talk extensively in like the book about the stuff, you know, the stuff it deals with, mental illness and misogyny and stuff like that, and why there's like stuff that is like worth leaving behind, but also stuff that's worth thinking about, right?
And I think that's why, you know, just going back to what you were saying earlier, I think that distancing technique is really effective way of dealing with that, because it does allow you to step back and, as you say, use the stereotypes, but in a more conscious way than finding yourself in a situation where you think, I don't feel happy about my character doing this. But if you, as you say, from the lens of a film, then it allows you that ability to have that distance and ironic distance as well, because you know more than the character,
and you, there's like a difference as well, like both kind of parts, the kind of the real and the yellow are kind of dark, but like the yellow is like hyper real, like it's like reality with the contrasts and saturation turned all the way up, so like you can really explore like really kind of like shock value, you know, stuff in the yellow, because that is what these films did after all, if you want to. But then in the real, you can be like, okay, let's look at that same issue. Let's take this truth. And part of it is true about my character. And now we're exploring this same issue we brought up in the film, but with a more nuanced kind of lens. And you're still playing like a flawed person who has done bad things, but like in a more kind of humanly grounded way. Because actually, like, something I love about Giallo is it's human. It's humanistic. Like it is. It's not essentialist in a weird way. Like it's pessimistic, yes. Nihilistic, oh boy, yes. But not like actually unaware. It's not. It's unaware of the reality of living as a human in the world, and like what that you don't always end up being the person you wanted to be. I mean, it's one of those things, right, where the best, for me anyway, the best thing that ever happens to you as a designer is you have an idea of how you want to get around the problem. You design a system to get around it, and then you run it, and it does it, right? And like, I genuinely, I've never had playtests go this well so quickly. Like, I've playtested a lot of games, and like, there's like half a dozen games that I just abandoned because the playtest went so badly. I was like, look, this isn't gonna work, right? And I need to move on. Or it's just too time consuming. But like, this is just one of those things where it just clicks so quickly.
Brilliant.
It's wonderful.
Well, I'm looking forward to the project coming together. And just remind us again when the Kickstarter goes live.
Yes, of course. So it's launching on June 24th. If you want to keep posted, then I'm on Blue Sky, Hardy Ridge Games, and I've got some of my old one pages on Itch as well, Hardy Ridge Games. And if you keep an eye on stuff on the page and on my Blue Sky or whatever in the next week or so, then I'll be dropping like the cinematic trailer for the game, which I put loads of effort into. I did a load of live action filming and editing and like 3D rendered animated sequences. And, you know, it's got one of the tracks from my amazing friend Ed underscoring it. I'm super excited about it. So, yes.
Well, good luck with it, Lawrence.
Thank you so much.
UK Games Expo.
Welcome to the Zoom of Role Playing Rambling. I've got Blithy with me. Hello, Blithy.
Hello, Dirk.
It's a school night, Blithy, but I've got a beer.
You got a beer? I got a cup of tea.
You're very sensible.
I'm very sensible. I mean, these days, I've always been sensible.
Yeah, good impulse control. I've bought one of those weird beers that I just got attracted to the can. And this one's called... It's from a company called Pretty Decent Beer, London. And they based this beer on one of their Google reviews. And it's called, I Could Get Better at Tesco's for a Quid.
That was the review, was it?
It must have been, yeah.
I'll tell you something now. There's nothing worse than beer reviews. Yeah, if you ever... thinking of buying some craft beer and you make the mistake, and it is a mistake, of Googling it and looking at a review, that there's nothing worse. The most, you'd think, wouldn't you, that beer is supposed to be fun. And you'd like to think, well, I like to think, when I've had a few beers, I'm a far more forgiving person than I am when I'm sober. But, oh no, these people, 3.5 stars out of 5. If you get 3.5 stars out of 5, you're doing well. Oh, slightly weak head. Pale amber colour, average. God, enjoy yourselves. You're having a beer.
Light on the tongue.
Yeah. Poor finish. Yeah.
Plummy aftertaste. I'm going to open this, so brace yourself.
Go on.
There you go. It's done, mate. Oh, sorry to do this to you. I'd have had a cup of tea if I'd known you were having
it. It's all right. I've just Googled it, and people say it's terrible. So I don't know. I don't feel like I'm missing out. Everything, all beer is terrible. According to beer connoisseurs, all beer is terrible. All of it. Terrible to average.
We've returned from UK Games Expo, and it has to be said that compared with some of our excursions to conventions, particularly, of course, for me, we were quite, quite light, weren't we?
Particularly you, yeah.
We were quite lightweight, though, didn't we? I was tucked up in my sofa bed by 12 most nights.
Yeah, well, we were kind of held captive by Ubers to some extent, weren't we? Because wherever we went, we couldn't really stagger home and get a kebab, could we? I mean, it was like you were at the hotel near Expo.
And or the Boston.
FringeCon. But either way, you couldn't really go, I'll tell you what, let's get leathered and stagger home and get a kebab. Because you couldn't, you had to try and get a Uber and all that kind of thing. So it was a tricky, tricky business game, bastard.
We upgraded this year, didn't we? You could say we upgraded. I don't know. You might have a different opinion, but normally we get a Premier Inn, don't we? And we enjoy the adequacy of a Premier Inn.
Yes, the adequacy of a Premier Inn, yeah.
But we decided that we'd get an Airbnb this time.
We did. The modern thing, get an Airbnb.
In a swanky district. Well, we thought it was swanky, but every time we mentioned we were near Broad Street, everybody kind of really? Are you all right?
Sharp and sick of breath. Oh, you're still alive. We're from Bolton. We think this is nice. Best of Bolton. Yeah. Much safer.
Yeah, we had an Airbnb. And the instructions they gave us to find a place were probably the most complex puzzle. Yeah. That we've ever had to face.
Yeah.
I'm going to take those instructions and use them in a game.
I know they did feel like some kind of dungeon puzzle to get into somewhere, wasn't it? You put this code number in, and then it'll let you through the automatic door, and then go to the third door on the right across the walkway. And it wasn't across the walkway, was it? It was just before the walkway, but you know, that nice lady told us, "Oh, you're going the wrong way." We'd probably still be there wandering around.
Yeah. These corridors, like some back rooms, endless space entering another dimension, just moving through these.
With the bizarre instruction.
Oh, yeah.
Do not speak to the concierge. Do not speak to the concierge, because we will be fined if you speak to the concierge. So it was like the gaze of the Gorgon, wasn't it? Whatever you do. I think at one point when we put the code in, Jonathan put the code in, and the concierge answered the intercom.
Yeah.
And we all went silent. So don't.
It's a test.
That sounds like the concierge. Don't ask him if he's a concierge, because that constitutes speaking to the concierge. So we just be quiet. I think it's the concierge, but let's not check, because that's a trick, and say nothing. So this poor concierge going, "Hello, anybody there? Who's there?" We just stood there in silence like some weird knock-a-door run people. Like a prank. Try again.
And when we got lost, that helpful woman said, "Well, the best thing to do if you're in this situation is speak to the concierge." And we said, "We can't do that.
We can't. We've been told not to do it." Although I did start to wonder how much is the fine. Because if the fine was a tenner, it got to a point where I was happy to pay a tenner. I was happy to pay the fine for them if the concierge would actually let us in.
Yeah.
It'd be worth it, wouldn't it? You know, between three of us, we could all chip in.
We found the room, didn't we? We walked in the room. And then there was like a sudden feeling that we shouldn't have been there.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't cleaned up from the previous occupants.
Yeah.
And therefore, it was a bit like a Tracy Emin installation, wasn't it?
It was Tracy Emin's bed without the condoms and the heroin syringes. I mean, that would have been a step too far, wouldn't it? But
well, there was apple crumble involved, wasn't there? Whatever they've been eating in that bed.
Apple crumble. Mm. Yeah. You won't step away from heroin if you're on apple crumble in the bed. It's a short, slippy slope to heroin, isn't it?
I think it was that point, because I could see Jonathan was with us and he was trying to calculate whether it was worth just putting up with it. And I said, no, we'll contact them. To clean it up, because it was a real mess, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Was that the first point where you thought, "I wish we'd retained the adequacy of the Premier Inn"?
I think I did at that point. Although, to be fair to the Airbnb owner, he did send you some money, didn't he? And said, "I'll get the cleaners," and sent you some money so we could get a couple of pints while we waited for it to be cleaned. So there was a reasonable amount of compensation. Did feel like asking him, though, that 30 quid you sent us for a few pints, is that more than the fine for the concierge or less? I'm still intrigued about what the level of penalty was for talking to the concierge.
I think it's at that stage. I mean, does this reflect badly on me? But at this stage, this is the perfect point of the weekend, isn't it? We travelled up on the Thursday, and this is the perfect point because it hasn't happened yet. And all you've got is the anticipation of what's to come.
Yeah. It's like a Friday afternoon in the office, isn't it? Where you think, that's the best bit of the weekend, because really, it's all in front of you. And it's not gone wrong yet.
Although, you know, we were there drinking, having a pint on this other person's money, weren't we? And just anticipating the weekend ahead as our digs were being prepared. But I think we always say that, don't we? That there is that sense of we're away from all the stresses and strains of normal life, and we're in this bubble for 3 days, and we'd better enjoy it, because otherwise, you know, we'll waste it. So let's look forward to it right now.
Yeah, and it was okay. The Airbnb in the end was all right. It was quite a nice little apartment, wasn't it? Although Jonathan did get very cross with me because I had an ensuite bathroom, didn't I? Which I didn't know about. When we claimed our bedrooms, I thought it was a cupboard, and I opened it. It was ensuite. No, I was fine. Thanks.
Yeah, I had the sofa bed. It was very good.
Very good. Yeah, you didn't mind the sofa bed, did you? Yeah.
No, I can sleep on a washing line. So
yeah, I'm as you know, I'm funny with beds because I just don't really fit in beds at all. You know, I'm too big for beds, really. That's the problem. Too long for a bed. So, but no, I thought it was good. It was nice, actually, you know. Not nice as well, because you could make a bit of breakfast in the morning. I think you commented on this. You could make a bit of breakfast in the morning in the apartment without having to go down to the hotel. And one English breakfast is nice, but three or four of them can be a bit much, I think.
Yeah,
so it was nice to just have a bit of tea and toast and think, okay, that'll do for now.
Yeah. And cups of tea with proper milk and everything.
Yeah, that's true as well. Proper tea bags, proper milk. That makes a difference, doesn't it? Having a nice cup of tea in the morning. It's what I'm used to, you know.
Yeah. We should explain that our UK Games Expo experience is split in two, isn't it? Because it's like the official event that we participate in, and we play games there, and we go to the trade hall, and we do other stuff while we're there, meet people while we're there. But there's also the ShadowCon that takes place, which is a group of the Grog Squad, commandeered by Orlanth Rex from Orlanth Rex's Gaming Vexes, and there's some games that take place there. So we divided our time between the official event at the NEC and the ShadowCon. That's why we ended up in the Ubers quite a lot, didn't we?
Yeah, it's Adventure, whatever it's called, Center, the Sub-Center. Which, if anyone listening is thinking of Googling that, finding out exactly where it is on a map, I'll save you some time. Don't bother. Because it's one of the hardest places in Birmingham to actually find. None of the taxi drivers know where it is.
We had this experience last year, but it was more acute this year for some reason. I think we tried to get there, didn't we, on the Friday night, and the taxi driver, I think he thought we were taking him hostage because we ended up in some industrial estate, didn't we? And he looked frightened for his life.
Yeah. And that happened last time. It seems to be that the sat-nav takes you to some industrial estate somewhere. And you think, well, this isn't it. Yeah, but I think you're right. I think he thought he was going to be taken hostage or something like that. But I think, though, it does demonstrate, our experience with the Ubers demonstrates the failure of the Uber system. Because it's great, isn't it? Going, the old Uber, we all do it now. On your phone, they know where you are. There we go. They know where they're going because it's all done through sat-nav and you prepay and all that. That's great. Brilliant. It's all right until it goes wrong. So when the Uber driver says, well, I think this is it. And you go, no, this isn't it. I think you need to go up there and round there. And he looks at you and says, oh, well, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, because you've paid for this point-to-point trip. Whereas if you're in like a black cab or something, you can say, no, just go around that corner. And obviously the bill will go up because it's on it.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine the situation when you've got this technology and people in Silicon Valley, they're looking forward to an age when you cut out the middleman. You don't have the Uber driver anymore. You've got these self-driving cars who pick you up and just drop you off in an industrial estate. And you have no way of negotiating anything because
no that's right. Yeah, you would have no way of even managing to convince the driver to take you somewhere else, would you? I mean, at least we managed to convince him, but
there'd just be a load of middle-aged men left in industrial estates in the middle of nowhere forming some kind of commune, like a Ballardian pact grouping together trying to find the way to some place where
I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. That's the nightmare future that awaits us, isn't it? Because at least with them, you could say, no, this isn't it. And to be fair to him, he wanted to find it. He said, oh, no, well, I'll find it, you know. Yeah. But the Robocar won't do that, will it?
No.
No.
That's our
future. Thank you. I have to say, that moment on Friday where we got lost in the Uber was, I don't know if it was better or worse than a few years ago where we got lost in the lingerie department of Primark.
Yeah.
In Birmingham, trying to find a way out of Primark because we've been told about a shortcut, do you remember?
Yeah.
Primark. Someone said, oh, go through Primark and just go through the doors at the other side and the bus stop's there. We went in and got lost and ended up in the lingerie section. And it was like that scene from Father Ted, you know, where you suddenly think, what are we wandering around ladies' underwear department for now? Get strange looks.
It's always when we're with Jonathan that we end up chasing buses.
He's a jinx. Just seeing if he has no, even though he had no part in organising any of it, but somehow he's.
So it's his fault. One of the things to say about UK Games Expo is the biggest one ever, I believe. They announced the statistics. I don't understand these. I think they count the number of tickets and the number of return visits and things like that separately, but something like 87,000.
Wow.
And there were something like 53,000 tickets. So it's the highest attended UK Games Expo ever. And it felt like that as well, didn't it? When you were walking around the trade halls, it felt like there was a lot of people around.
Well, the trade halls were a lot bigger, weren't they? It seemed bigger this time.
Well, they took over everywhere, didn't they? They took over all the different halls. We'll talk a little bit about the trade hall experience, but I've got a prefab sprout game. I know we normally do these at the beginning.
Oh, session. Okay.
But it's almost like I forgot that I had one.
Almost like these things not really very well planned. It's just us talking.
One of the explorers, one of the people who've got the endurance to go around those trade halls and visit every single place, they've got to be Pookie, hasn't it?
Yeah. Pookie, he should get some kind of award, like the Ironman or the marathon or some. It's almost like an Olympic level thing, isn't it? That he goes around like that with his big bag.
Reviews from Relier. So he's a blogger and a reviewer. And as part of his mission to try and improve and sustain his huge collection, goodness knows how he does anything other than write reviews in that house of his. But yeah, he's filling out his collection. And he had that knee this time as his chaperone looking after him. Because sometimes we've been commandeered into carrying his bags, but this year we've avoided it. Yeah. So I watched his unboxing of his bags, or his unbagging of his bags. And
unbagging of his boxes, whatever, Okay.
I think if you want to see the cornucopia of different esoteric and exotic RPGs that are available out there in the marketplace, you should go and see the different things, the complete melange of different things that he carries in his bag, to see what variety there is. And I'm going to pick out some from the bag now. You know how this works? There's five of them. One of
five
them
I've made up. Okay. One he made up.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. These came out of Pookie's bag. Are you ready? So make a comment when you hear them. If you think, oh yeah, that's true. And then we'll see if we can settle on which one. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, let's do the first one. Zephyr is an anarchist fantasy game of fleeting identities. You travel across the wandering sentient landmass of Ophoi on a strange journey to fulfill sacred obligations and find your way back home. Zephyr. Yeah. Would you play that?
Not sure. Seems a bit too high concept for me.
What, finding your way back home?
No, sentient landmass. Shooting identities is, well, I don't know, maybe it's okay.
Sounds
a bit like Spire, doesn't it? Sounds like it's in that kind of bracket, isn't it?
What about this one then? Does that sound convincing, that one?
Yeah, it sounds convincing, but then there's all sorts of crazy stuff out there, isn't there? So, yeah.
Let's try this one then. Ripples Creeks. Now, this was a scenario collection for the Cryptic Curse collection. Cryptic Creeks. You play a crew of river scouts setting out to save a place. You're guided by a benevolent... I'm going to start that again. You're guided by a benevolent cryptid called the Watcher, and you've got to track down clues before it's too late.
Well, what's too late?
Before the cryptid to take over. I think there's benevolent cryptids and there's cryptid.
Oh, right. That sounds dodgy because you're not really, you're faltering a bit there, but anyway. Is that a role playing game?
If I told you that it was based on the Brindlewood Bay.
Oh, okay. It's a role playing game, is it? Yeah.
It's a role playing game, yeah.
Okay.
Would that help you? Would that give it a sense of authenticity?
Not really, because you could just be saying that, couldn't you?
Okay. So it's doubtful, that one, yeah?
Doubtful, that one. Putting it under doubtful at the moment, yeah.
What about Dogs in Berlin? You play scavenging dogs wandering the streets of Berlin looking for discarded rubbish as treasure, kebabs and cigarette butts. You can improve your lot by making friends and finding human companions who will ride on your back.
It sounded convincing until you said human companions. I thought, okay, this sounds like a game someone could come up with. It might work. Who ride on your back?
Yeah.
What if you're like a pug or a Jack Russell? Who's riding on your back? What's those?
Little humans.
Little humans. Yeah. But it seemed like plausible then as a role playing game. All right, you play a dog, and you're changing like scraps of food and treasure, you know, and all that kind of thing. That might work. But why are the humans riding them back?
Well,
I'm putting that on the doubtful.
Let's go for this one then. Kaiju Control with a K. So Control with a K. Kaiju Control is a Sunday matinee B movie. Eager, energetic, goofy, and endearing game. It's a bit loose. It's a loose game of asking questions until the kaiju battle it out, and you feel like you're there in a rubber suit walking over models. So, you want to play that one? I've got that on my shelf. Would you come and play that?
Maybe I'm putting that on doubtful as well. They're all going to doubtful, aren't they, really?
This is my final one, and then you have to decide, make some decisions here.
Okay.
Wraith of the Wyvern, a dark fantasy solo role-playing game. And this is The Witcher meets Skyrim. In The Wraith of the Wyvern, you venture out into the Highlands, the Celtic Highlands.
Mm. Do what?
So, which one have I made up? The Wraith of the Wyvern, Kaiju Control.
What did you do in The Wraith of the Wyvern? What did you do? Go into the Highlands and do what?
I think you fight monsters.
Oh, I see.
What do you do in Skyrim? Is that what you do?
I don't know. I'm a bad Skyrim.
All right. So that blurb is lost on us, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think that could be... All right. The ones I'm doubting, the two I'm doubting, and I know I'm always wrong, is the one about the dogs, simply because humans riding on the back. That just seems completely weird. It seems plausible until humans ride on the back. It doesn't make sense.
Eating street detritus like kebabs and cigarette butts, you love that. Yeah.
Well, to a point, but I mean, you could see it. All right, you play it. I'm not sure I'd want to play that game. Well, you could see it. You could play a game where you're a dog in Berlin and you've got to get food, befriend humans, and survive. I suppose that might work as a survival-type role-playing game. Swap out the dungeon for the streets of Berlin. Swap out gold pieces for old kebabs and burgers left in bins and, you know, monsters for humans that you've got to befriend or deal with. So that all works.
Sounds great, this game.
It sounds good. Until somebody says, and the humans ride on your back.
That's when you level up, though. That's when you get better.
When you level up to a giant Jack Russell. An enormous Jack Russell. Oh, I'm a level 23 poodle. I've got a small family and a house on my back. Oh, right. Oh, a level 10 Jack Russell. I've just got the local butcher on my back with his sausages. Yeah. So that seems...
Are you saying that one's the ring?
Well, no, that could be. But I think the kaiju one as well, although the kaiju one sounds plausible as well, you didn't sell it. You just didn't sell that one to me. You're in a rubber suit crushing model. I thought, who would describe the game like that?
Well, that one's available on Drive-Thru in Itch.
Is it? Right. Yeah. Well, I'm going to say that Dogs of Berlin is the one you made
Dogs
up.
Of Berlin. Dogs of Berlin is completely made up, and it was me kind of riffing on one of the games.
I've got it right.
Well done.
Thank you.
It was me riffing on one of the games that was a talk of the weekend, which was Tales of the Crichton Age, which...
Oh, yeah, that Steve got. Yeah.
And I think it's by one of the writers of the Sky Realms of Jerun. It's a kind of a high concept universe involving insects, isn't it? It's like Europe, but with insects and people ride on the backs of them.
Yeah. I was there when Steve was kind of trying to sell it to us all.
And it's got a 4-page character sheet.
That's right. That was passed round, wasn't it? In awe.
And the artwork features a French insect. Did we know there was a French insect?
He's wearing a beret, wasn't he? And not only was he a French insect, he was a stereotypical French insect.
Yeah.
If such a thing could be imagined. Did you have like a little moustache? And
yeah.
Did you have onions around this?
I think we added the onions in our.
They just went after you.
Well, I think it just goes to show, you know, you see what Pookie picked up, and there's a lot of games out there. Part of the talk we had in the pub, Tasmin came over, and she was kind of challenging the setup of this as a commercial event, that the whole idea is to sell stuff into, which is, you know, legitimate. It's a trade show to sell stuff. But she asked a pretty decent question, which was, if you were, so your daughter's got into Baldur's Gate, if she walked into that hall, would she know where to go next? What are the top 10 role-playing games and alternatives to D&D? Would you be able to get a sense of that from walking?
I don't think you would. And I think one of the strange things about it, the trade hall, is, I mean, you like to think we would know what to look at, and yet we find it completely bewildering, don't we? Or I do, at least, think you're the same. I think a lot of people do find it quite an overwhelming experience. There's a lot of stalls. And yeah, you see Free League and you see Caecium and you see Modiphius and that. But you're right. If you had played some D&D, 5th edition D&D, like my daughter has, and you walked in, you wouldn't really know where to start. You wouldn't have any sense of direction about it. No, that's very true.
Because even the people who have a lot of stock, so Leisure Games and companies like that, and I don't blame them for this, but it still seems like very specialist when it comes to the role-playing stuff. And it's a bit like a yard sale almost, isn't it? They have them stacked in boxes, and yet there's assumption that they'll be at bargain prices, but they're not. And
no,
if I didn't know what I was looking for, where would you start in all that? It doesn't tell a story of what games are available, role-playing games are available. Whereas me, I don't know anything about board games, but I got a sense from wandering around the hall that Battle for Hoth was a new game that they were promoting heavily. I had a sense that Wingspan was a very popular game, and you know, I was drawn towards that. You can very easily see what are the main players in the board game world. You didn't get that sense at all from the role playing game, I guess.
No. I'd say two things about it. I mean, I went in thinking with a very clear idea. What I wanted was a Shadow Dark GM screen.
Yes.
I thought, surely there'll be one knocking around this place. Look at that girl. And I'm glad, I'm really glad that we went to All Rolled Up. We bumped into Paul. And Paul said to me, no, they're out of print. No one could get hold of them. And when he told me that, I was slightly disappointed, a bit crestfallen. I thought, oh, that's a shame. I wanted one. I'm glad he did, because otherwise I'd have spent hours and hours going around every store, looking at every shelf and every, you know, because like you say, it's not particularly coordinated, looking for something that didn't exist, that wasn't there. So thank God Paul told me that it's just out of print, because it saved me the torment of trying to find something that didn't exist.
Yeah, you know, in a big room.
That's the thing. But the other thing I would say about it, I think this is a strange thing, is Some people seem to be really good at it. I was looking at Neil at Old Scouser Roleplay, and he posted some stuff he got trade on. I looked at it, I thought, oh, that looks really good. I didn't see that. I'm just not looking in the right places. I would have bought those. You know, he bought some like scenarios and things for stuff for Shadow Dark and a few other things, and they all look really good. And I thought, I didn't see those. I was just looking in the wrong place. But then he's so big, it's easy to do that, isn't it, I think?
There are some that do it really well. I saw the Pirate Borg stall, and I thought they did a really good job.
Mm.
They put some effort into building a stall that looked like a pirate ship. So that helps, doesn't it? You know, you get an instant sense of this is what this game does. And they had the way that they displayed it, it told you the story of what the component parts were, what you got for your money, and what to expect from it. And there were people at hand to explain it to people as well. And they seemed to be doing really well because they had that attitude of, we're going to show you what this is. We're going to set out to you what this is so you can go away and you can make a decision based on what you see because you know what you're getting.
Yeah, 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 you're right. Whereas other things, it's just a kind of mass of stuff. The trade-off always reminds me of being about 5 years old on Christmas Day where, you know, you open all your presents, but you're a bit overtired. There's too much going on. But before you know it, you kind of sat down in tears, getting very upset for no apparent reason. It's a bit like that, isn't it? All this stuff. But I'm tired now. I've been wandering around for ages. There's all this stuff. I don't know what to buy. It's all a bit too much. I have to go and have a drink somewhere.
You cry in a corner.
Cry in a corner. Somehow it's brilliant. But at the same time, slightly, weirdly nightmarish.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think it's just down to the volume of people because people say, oh, it's very busy, it's got very busy. Mm. I think it's just overstimulating. It's just too much stuff and it's very hard to get your eyes to kind of fix on points to think, oh, yeah, this is worth looking at.
Oh, no, they sat in our chairs.
No, I was a bit more selective this time. I think last year, I did a bit of a supermarket sweep and I had some ideas of things I wanted to get. But this time I was a bit more cautious about it. If I'm getting stuff, it needs to be something that I'm going to play and I'm going to schedule to play. Perhaps we can talk about what we got.
There's a lot of expensive stuff there as well, isn't there? I mean, I had a bit of a shock, didn't I, with looking at dice because, as you said earlier, my daughter's got into Baldur's Gate, plays a bit of D&D. And there was a dice store, and it was selling dice. And I mean, it's obvious now what else could these numbers have meant. But next to some of the dice, it said 95 and some of them 75. And there was some Baldur's Gate dice. And I thought, well, it'd be a nice present for my daughter, wouldn't it? And I said to the guy, hey, what are these? And he said 75. And I said, pounds? That's what the 75 means, isn't it? Not just random numbers he put next to his dice set. And he looked at me, like slightly disgusted as I put them back, and said, the handmade dice. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, I don't know. Do I need a handmade dice better than machine made? I mean, is the machine not more precise? I don't know. But there's lots of stuff like that, isn't there? You go around, there's lots of like, you know, wooden dice trays and dice towers and dice bag, leather dice bags and things like that. They're quite the pricey end of the market, aren't they? I always think.
Yeah. Those items are for people who have everything and you want to buy a gift for somebody.
Yeah.
Might be a special gift that you want to give them at a particular point.
Yeah.
I think I much prefer to have that kind of artisan stuff and that kind of unique stuff than some of the AI stuff that they had, which has caused a bit of controversy because there were stalls selling materials that were used in AI art and printed materials. So I think I much prefer that there's those kind of unique items that we're not in the market for them, are we? Clearly. But there are people who will buy that kind of prestige.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I just, being a skinflint, I just look at it and think, Yeah. I'd momentarily turn into Eddie and say,
yeah.
But surely that's just a glorified pencil case.
So what did you buy then?
I bought some more dice. I bought those kind of big chunky dice you've got set, haven't you? From All Rolled Up, the big...
the big ones.
They call them megahedrals, they call them. Quite big. Yeah. Quite like them.
They're good. They're good for convention games.
Yeah, they are, actually, because everyone can see your dice. And I use them in my game on Sunday morning. So, yeah, they're good. And I bought, the other thing I bought, Troubleshooters. The Troubleshooters RPG, which I played, which you ran on the Friday morning at Expo. And I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it so much that I bought the game.
You brought the Prime Directive and got a
copy. I brought the Prime Directive, but yeah, I bought it because I really, really enjoyed it. I think it's a really nice, neat game. Bit different from the stuff we play normally, but at the same time, has a lot of familiar elements in it that work very, very well. I would say, this might be a very bold statement, this, but it's one of the best interpretations of BRP that I've encountered, I think. I mean, I like the 7th edition Call of Cthulhu version of BRP with luck and with hard successes and extreme successes and all that. I think that's a nice version of it. But I think Troubleshooter's version is... It's hard to explain, isn't it? But it works really well. So it gives you things where you can spend, luck points, where you can...
Yeah, story points, aren't they?
Story points, where you can spend a story point to reverse the numbers. So you can reverse the numbers. So if you roll 52 and your skill's 30%, spend a luck token and switch it to 25, can't you? You can do that. That's one thing you can do. And then the thing with pips, where if you get a 2-pip bonus, if the units is a 1 or a 2, you still succeed. So if your skill is 50%, you've got a 2-pip bonus and you rolled 81. You still succeed because you've got a 1. It's very clever. And I thought it worked very, very well when we were playing it.
It's a bit tricky
to get your head around. It's a bit tricky to explain because you explained it to me a few days before we played it. And I remember thinking, I'm not quite sure I get that. But it's surprising that once we're 10 minutes into playing it, it very, very quickly made sense. And I thought it worked. Really nice game, good fun. And I like that fiction. It's set in like a fictional 1960s, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like comic book, like Tintin or the Avengers, that kind of stuff. Crazy science and mad scientists and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Really, really, really good game. So that's one of the good things about the trade hall, that what I could do after the game when we went to the trade hall is buy that game because it's there. Yeah. Like, go and buy it.
I mean, we should point out that even though it uses percentiles, it doesn't trade itself as a BRP derivative. It's its own thing, isn't it? It's kind of a Swedish game. If you pick up the rule book, it is very consistent with the art and it gives that flavour, doesn't it, of comic book Tintin universe. I played it at Grogmeet. I ran my first game at Grogmeet and I learned a lot from that experience in that what you realise is that story point economy is very important to it. And when I played it the first time, I didn't really drive that. But in this one, it was an important element, wasn't it? So you were constantly using your story points to adjust things. And you were also seeking as players how to refresh them because you knew that they were vital for you to succeed in some situations. I think what it does for those percentile games is that it just makes you feel more competent and able to do things, doesn't it?
Well, it's like, you're right. It's not BRP as such, is it? I suppose when I say BRP, what I mean is it's a percentile system.
Yes.
And on the face of it, it has the same kind of flaws where you're at 15% in a skill and you think, oh, for God's sake, I'm never going to make that roll. But there's enough in the game that you can make those rolls if you get the story points and you can manipulate things or use an ability or use a piece of equipment that gives you the pips bonus and things like that. You can actually do things which on the face of it, if it was just a straight percentile system, you'd be hopeless like you are in those kind of games. But you're not hopeless. You've got ways of manipulating it. But at the same time, you're not always going to succeed. I thought it was a nice balance that people did fail, but also you weren't staring down the barrel of failure when you had a 20% chance of doing something. You did know, oh, hang on, there are a few things I can possibly do here to augment that and be successful.
Yeah, because the other element of the game is if you get doubles, so 11, 22, 33, you get good karma if it's under your skill, bad karma if it's over your skill. And that created some interesting situations as well, didn't it?
Yeah.
And because of the setting, which is that kind of optimism of the 60s where science and international travel is the flavour of the day, and it really sets about being more knockabout than, you know, you're not going to die in this. In fact,
no.
It discourages you mechanically from violence, really, out and out violence.
That was interesting that we didn't have guns. There were a few fights. There were some punch ups, weren't there?
Yeah.
Because my character was a journalist who was a black belt in karate. She knocked a boxer out, didn't she?
Yeah.
Knocked him down a laundry chute or something. There were like fights, but yeah, it's interesting. There were no guns. It was all like you say, knockabout. Kung Fu and punching people, not machine gunning people to death or anything like that. It was more, brawling, that kind of thing, which again can be unusual in a game because a lot of games like that default to guns, don't they? A lot of the time. It's eventually it all defaults to everyone having a gun. But I did think it was very good. And the other thing I liked about it was it has things like story points and it has things where if you play to your weaknesses or you play to this or you play to that, you get story points. But again, I thought it was a nice balance between that story game stuff, a more traditional role-playing game where you're rolling dice to do things, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It's a nice balance. It's not a very mechanical, traditional role-playing game that's trying to be like the Avengers and failing. And equally, it's not all story points and inventing stuff and justifying this and justifying that. It's a nice sweet spot between feeling like you're playing a regular role-playing game where you're rolling dice and doing this and doing that, and then also on top of it, you are sometimes using story elements to fuel the action a bit. But there's not too much of one or the other. I think that's quite an achievement with it, quite a nice balance, really. Very good game, I thought. Really good.
Of course, I used the usual safety speak, as I always do before a game, setting out the cats, the concept, action, tone, and safety tools. And I gave a trigger warning, because that morning, Bezos's rockets had blown up on the launch pad, and that was the subject matter of
it
the...
It was a rocket you had to blow up, yeah.
But it's topical. People felt quite comfortable about seeing Jeff Bezos' rocket blowing up.
So. Yeah, people are almost happy to be reminded, weren't they? Yeah.
Good. So what other game did you play at Expo? You ran a game, didn't you?
At Expo, I ran Cult of the Reptile God, an old AD&D module that I kind of converted into Old School Essentials. There's always a good, in all the AD&D modules, there's a good adventure trying to get out.
Have you done that one before? Or is this the first time you've done it?
First time I've done it. Yeah. No, it's good. And I met Michael Davis, the man who sent me his Return of the Ripper Dungeon Crawl Classics adventure. He was there and he played in your...
Troubleshooters game, yeah.
Troubleshooters game as well, but we didn't
know. Do you know what else, Blindy, is Ripper supplement for DCC?
Came yeah,
Spooky's bag.
Did it?
Yeah.
Well, he said, do you know what? After the, it's very interesting that, because he said he'd sold someone. I thought, all right, okay, so there you go. Spooky was one of the purchases.
And he described the writer as a ripperologist. Is he a ripperologist?
I don't know if he didn't describe himself as a ripperologist to me, but I think he could be, yeah. I think he's very au fait with the history of it, yeah. Yeah.
It's quite unusual, isn't it? It's quite unusual to have a DCC game, but it's kind of an urban fantasy type thing.
Yeah. It's like a city adventure. Yeah. Yeah. Quite a chunky adventure. Yeah. Quite a little, almost like a little mini campaign. It's quite a big adventure. Yeah. Yeah.
But, so
he's a, yeah, I think he, he I got the feeling he knows about the Jack the Ripper kind of stuff.
Yeah.
As a Ripperologist, I didn't know that was a thing, but maybe he is. Yeah. As well as moments, I mean, as he left, he was heading back to Geneva where he lives. He works for the CERN, you know, the CERN thing, the CERN project.
Yeah.
He looks at that. And I just thought, where did I go wrong? Hey? There you go. Local government in north of England.
It's little wonder when I was ham-fistedly describing this future tech.
Yeah,
he was actually saying what the name was, wasn't he?
No, that's you with you. You've made up nonsense. Somebody works in the scientific world. All right, okay.
Good. I played in the morning with Sunday morning whilst you were doing that. I joined Paul Fricker's charity game. Chaosium guys were running games throughout the weekend and they charged slightly more, not a lot more. I think it was £3 more.
Yeah.
And it was like a charity event.
So, For charity.
So,
it's not for old Paul. It's to be clear.
He didn't hand the ball out at the end of it and ask for tips. But I think Jonathan played a Rivers of London game run by Lynn Hardy the Friday morning, didn't he?
Yeah.
Part of the same thing. But I won't give too much away, but it's an adventure that's appearing in the forthcoming Innsmouth book, which is companion to the Arkham book that they did a couple of years ago. And yeah, it was really good. Because Paul was saying that, because you've got Innsmouth, it's very difficult to avoid the fact that deep ones are involved, but this scenario kind of moved a little bit away. It's quite a different investigation with different outcomes. But what I would say is, if you've never played with Paul Fricker as an NGM, he is terrifying.
He's not. You know,
the Innsmouth look, he had a baseball cap on and he was playing like the people of Innsmouth, and he was very convincing. There was a point where he shouted very loudly and I genuinely felt the hairs on the back of my neck come up and I thought, wow. And it reminded me that the scope of Call of Cthulhu, I think in recent years, I've tended to err towards the Call of Cthulhu as a horror adventure type approach. Mm. But you forget that with that game, you can create some terrifying scenes, can't you?
Yeah. Well, I think we've said before, it's quite a versatile game, isn't it, Call of Cthulhu? You can do a lot with it. And I suppose by virtue of the fact you can do a lot with it, you perhaps sometimes drift away from its origins as a horror game, whereas, you might play it more like an adventure horror type thing. I mean, I think when we were younger, when we were kids, we always played it a bit like that, didn't we? We always played it in a kind of pulpy way, didn't we?
Yeah.
Even though, but you're right, that's not necessarily its origins, is it? Its origins are that it's a proper horror game, isn't it?
Yeah,
proper horror. You're doomed and everything, yeah.
Very creepy people that kind of emerge from it. And when you're interacting with them, it can set you on edge. So, yeah, that was a good game. I look forward to seeing that.
And also, I think the good thing about Expo in the Twitch, you do meet people. I think that's one of the good things. I mean, you know, sometimes you might say that's not necessarily a good thing, but it is one of the conventions. Of all the conventions where you go to during the year, it's the one where you do meet different people, or you mix with different people that you don't normally meet at some of the smaller conventions. So there is that kind of side to it, which can sometimes be a good thing, I think, you know, opportunities to play with different people, that kind of thing. So it's good. Although I did, I must mention, I did have the thing that happened a few years ago, where when I got to my room on Sunday morning, there was no table for me. Again, there was no table. I don't even told you that. Did I tell you this or not?
I don't think I did. I saw you wandering about.
Yeah, well, when I got there, I got into the room. I was in the right room, and I looked around, and there was like all the tables were occupied. So I went back to I thought, oh, he would go again. This happened a few years ago, so I'd go again. And that's the time when I lost all the players because the players couldn't find me. So I went back to the desk And to be fair to the guy behind Export, he handled it very well. He came with me to the room and he dealt with it. But it was funny because it was like being at school. We walked in and I was stood next to him looking rather sheepish. And he went, right, someone's in the wrong room. One of you shouldn't be here. He should be here. One of you shouldn't be. So I'm going to read out the games. And you it should be in here. And you tell me whether it's you. So he read out each game and everyone went, Yeah, that's me. Oh dear, I'm in the wrong room. And he said, "Well, you
move all his bling."
Yeah, he had all his bling out and everything. And the guy organized it. Well, you're going to have to move because he's right. It's all right to put him in another room like me, but his players will struggle to find him. So you have to move. Oh, and he's to be fair, the guy said, "I'm sorry," but to stand there in this kind of weird silence. But felt like an eternity. It felt like an eternity. Where he gathered his GM screen up and his dice tray and his tokens and his map and folded his map and put his map in his bag and put this in his bag and put that in his bag. I'm just stood there thinking, oh, come on, hurry up. This is awkward. And and then he left. But it felt
a bit tighter, though, I think, in general, the organisation. Mm. There were more RPGs running than ever before, but I did think that the organisation was a lot better and they got rid of all those little slips that you have to hand in and all that.
It was, and I suppose that's my point. There was a cock-up where someone had obviously, for whatever reason, probably genuine mistake, gone in the wrong room, set up and that, fine. But they did handle it very well, I thought. You're right, it did seem slicker kind of organisation, a bit tighter, and they did deal with it and they found him and he went away with this guy and said, "Look, don't worry, I'll find out where you should be." So although he helped me get my table, he helped the other guy as well because he left with him and said, "I'll come with me, I'll show you where you should be, I'll find out which room you should be in and that." So yeah, in that way, it's a bit more, it did feel a bit of a slicker operation.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
We didn't only play games at Expo, we also went to Borstal, this off the dual carriageway to the ShadowCon, and there were games being played there on the Saturday. So what did you play in the morning?
In the morning, I played Conan, the new Conan, Monolith Games. Yeah, I played the new Conan game. That's what I played in the morning, run by Matthew Broom. Mine's very good. I enjoyed it. Yeah. I didn't know what to expect because I signed up to it thinking, oh, well, I'll play the new Conan and see what that's like because, you know, I've played the 2D20 one and we found that a bit, it was a bit kind of complicated and what have you. Well, this was very simple and slick. It was kind of, it reminded me a bit of Barbarians of Lemuria. It's not the same system, but reminded me a bit of that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But enjoyed it. Yeah, it was good. Quite a good game. I don't think. I'm sure Matthew said you can't. It's not for sale yet. I think he'd done the Kickstarter, but he said it. I'm not sure it's at retail yet. So I don't know if you can buy it.
I think PDF is available, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But that was, enjoyed it. Good.
Yeah. In the morning, I played Cimborium, the Free League version, because I think there's a new version that's currently being kickstarted, but the old one that you can't get for love nor money apparently because they've all gone out of circulation ahead of the new version. I never played in that world before, but it reminded me a little bit of our experience of playing Harn with Eddie.
Yeah.
It felt like a world that was well documented with maps and a bit like Eddie plays Harn in the Robin of Sherwood kind of mode, where it's very green and lush and simple.
Yeah.
And that's what the world feels like. Some of the humans have migrated out of areas because of this blighted curse, and your role in the game is to return to some of those areas to kind of recover. It's like post-apocalyptic almost. Some of the monuments that the humans have left behind, and they're trying to avoid this corruption and curse, and the magic causes this blight. So it's quite dark
I guess, in a sense. It feels very European. But yeah, it was good fun. We faced a terrifying abomination at the end. And there was only three of us playing, which was quite nice because of the trio of players. I was an inept treasure hunter. We had a little goblin and also a duelist who was a changeling. So it was kind of a good, it felt very like a Robert Silverberg type adventure. It was good fun.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Yeah, never heard of it. Never played it.
No.
Boring. No. I didn't know much about it, to be honest with you. It's one of those things I've seen, but never even gone beyond the cover, I don't think.
Dave Patterson run it for us, and he has really got into it and got all the stuff. Run a good game. It was good. Felt like I really understood where the game was coming from at the end of it. So. In the afternoon, played Vason. I played an adventure, I think you've done before.
I played Grogmeat, Mike's game with Vason, very good. I enjoy Mike's games with Vason, and I enjoy Vason anyway.
Yeah. Film Fan Mike is the king of bling.
he is, isn't he? It's like, it's not all bling, but the bling that you get is very good bling. That's what I would say. Yeah.
So the character sheets are delivered to you with a wax seal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's, I like that. Yeah, you don't know where you're getting, do you? Until you open it. Yeah.
And you open it up, and there's handouts galore. And it's a really good scenario, actually, set in London.
Yeah.
And they're quite procedural, aren't they? Those Vason kind of investigations. But it's quite good because there was a couple of things going on that were unraveling simultaneously. And it made the story quite interesting.
Mm.
Good characters as well.
Yeah. No, very good.
And what did you play in the afternoon?
I played Neil's game of Shadow Dark. I played a bit of Shadow Dark, which I was quite looking forward to. And I enjoyed it a lot, actually.
There's a lot of people in the Grog Squad who've contacted me to say that we need to get into Shadow Dark and investigate it and speak to the creator, and also people are quite keen on us exploring it further. So what did you get from playing it?
Well, it was a good old-fashioned dungeon crawl, but I would say the dungeon itself was quite cleverly constructed. So it was called Raiders of the Lost Tomb. And there's a bit, took me ages to work it out, this. Neil was laughing, but at the end, there was a certain point in it where, I won't spoil it, but there's bits where I thought, oh, it's based on Red as a Lost Art, isn't it? I've not really worked that out until now. But anyway, it was quite a clever dungeon, where one of those dungeons that has like a couple of factions in, you don't quite know which faction to trust. So part of it is not just going through the rooms, killing monsters. It's working out. These factions are kind of, one of them's lying to you about what's going on. And of course, you have to kind of work out which one's the bad faction, which one's the okay faction, and deal with it. So it's one of those kind of dungeons, little dungeon. And written by Kelsey Dion, the person who wrote Shadow Dark. It's an OSR type game, but I suppose it brings in a few things from 5th edition, like advantage, disadvantage, and stuff like that. But it's quite a nice game. If you're looking for like kind of an old school game, which has a few new school things in it, it's okay. It's a good choice, you know. And there are some elements in it. There are some elements in it that you wouldn't really get in a one shot. Things about character progression. So. As you go up the levels, you roll on a table to see what talent you get, rather than get, you know, fixed. You know, like in a lot of old school games, when you become a third level fighter, you get another +1 to hit, you get some more hit points, and you get this, that's it. You actually roll on a table and get different things depending on what you roll. So all the characters, as they advance, they all become slightly different. You know, one fourth level wizard will be different from another fourth level wizard because they'll have different, slightly different abilities and things like that. So it's got some nice touches like that in, which you wouldn't necessarily get at a one shot. You can see why people like it. And one, what I can see as well is why people, and I don't want to sound patronizing when I talk about young people here, like I'm an old duffer who I am, but there's you can imagine somebody who's played fifth edition moving to Shadow Dark and it feeling like a breath of fresh air, because it has a lot of, it has the same kind of feel as fifth edition, but it's stripped back and simpler. And you could see why a generation of gamers who get into fifth edition D&D as a kind of the gateway drug, like we always say, like my daughter. Daughter's got into Baldur's Gate, but fifth edition is that much, and we've played old school essentials and a bit of Shadow Dark, and she kind of prefers that. You can see why people would get excited about it, because if you switched from one to the other, you would find it perhaps quite refreshing that it has a lot of simplicity to it. And also, I played a wizard in a dungeon, and I'm never happy really when I'm a wizard in a dungeon. Yeah. I'm sorry. I know some of these games are sophisticated. I could be playing a dog in Berlin with people riding on my back. I could be doing that, couldn't I? There's nothing wrong with that, even though it was made up. I could be a Kaju in a rubber suit crushing models. I could be all those things, or I could be traveling across a sentient landscape. But sometimes I quite like being a wizard in a dungeon.
Yeah,
quite like that. Thanks very much.
Sometimes I come away from these events blindly, and I feel like exhausted. But I must admit, this time I felt a bit differently. I came away from it feeling invigorated, and particularly that last game of Call of Cthulhu with Paul. It really inspired me to want to play more. I felt like my game went well. I felt like the games I played were really good.
Yeah, yeah. And I felt the same, really. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, came away from it feeling that it was a good event. Before we go, what I bought, for the record, I bought that Outgunned.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and that's a bit of a prime directive break.
But I've got the adventure one. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and I also bought the Dragonbane campaign.
Oh yeah,
glory. Yeah, I wasn't going to buy anything that I wasn't going to play, so I've already booked it in, haven't I? I've already put a mark that we're playing it on our Wednesday group.
No, I would say it's one of the best, possibly the best expo we've been to. I would say. I think it's partly learning how to navigate it a bit as well.
Yeah.
I think some of the early expos were a bit of a bumpy ride for us, weren't they?
Yeah.
Some of the games we ended up on and some of the things we experienced were a little bit, we came away feeling a little bit despondent or a bit slightly confused about the whole hobby. But I think now we've kind of, even like the trade hall, I bought Troubleshooters. The GM screen Troubleshooters as well. But I feel like I bought those and I'll play them and I wanted to buy them. And a bit like you, that sense of, I will use this. I've not bought some rubbish. Whereas in the past, sometimes I've kind of bought stuff that I've come away thinking, well, what the hell have I bought this for? It's not a good idea at the time. But I don't think we're as susceptible to that now. And I think as well, choosing the games that we play and run, we kind of, it's a bit of an art, isn't it? You know, doing these things. It's like people who go to, I don't know, music festivals and things like that. You know, you hear people who go to Glastonbury always say, oh, the first time I went to Glastonbury was a disaster because I didn't know what I was doing. And I got really drunk or I did this or I did that and I missed this and missed that. And then eventually they perfect it so that they get what they want from it. And it felt a bit like with Expo that we're getting to the point where we're kind of getting what we want from it now.
Yeah.
And that's no bad thing, really.
Yeah. Although I do think next time we'll have a fallow year, because we always enjoy that. To use the Glastonbury analogy, I think it'd be good to try something different. And good. And just coming back, before we end, we should also say that we're very lucky to be alive, aren't we? Because we used one of our 9 lives during that weekend.
Oh, we did. The taxi coming home from Expo, from the hotel. Was it on the Saturday night?
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah, that was quite a scary experience, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know you're in trouble when you instinctively and almost involuntarily say to the taxi driver, slow down, like I did.
At one point, I just said, slow down. Two things didn't help that journey. Well, three things. The first thing that didn't help was you drove like a maniac. But that's the one thing that didn't help. But the other things that didn't help were the fact that I was in the front and I could see two cans of Red Bull. And I thought, oh, you run two cans of Red Bull, are you? You've had a long shift. And the other thing that didn't help was when we were waiting outside the hotel for it, Jonathan said, well, he's pulled into a lay-by. When has he done that? And he was in a lay-by for a few minutes, do you remember?
Yeah, yeah.
He pulled into a road and Jonathan said, oh, he stopped. Why has he stopped? And then about 3 or 4 minutes later, he started again and he was on his way. And when we were in the car on the motorway and he was driving like a maniac, I had visions of him stopping this lay-by, saying, come on, wake up, wake up. Have some more Red Bull. You'll be okay. You'll get through this. Yeah. Quite terrifying, you know, as we stumbled out of the car, all shaking slightly.
I extract my fingers from the back of the seat.
Yeah. One by one. Jonathan, you were talking in the back, but every so often you would realise the jeopardy you were in. And you were saying things like, well, the thing about Glorantha, stuff like you're so
curling up.
You were trying to talk in a casual way. So we were just, what, calm everyone down. Chris is going to talk about role-playing games in the back. He's going to talk about role-playing games in the back and it'll all be fine. But every now and again, your voice just trailed off as he overtook another vehicle at 95 miles an hour. Because I was in the front and I could see speed he was doing.
All we can hope for is the time when there'll be driverless cars and we'll get there safely.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. The robo cars won't do that, will they? It'll be fine.
Right. See you later, Blythe.
See ya.
All right. This Cowie Norland Vexes Gaming Rexes or whatever it is.
Thanks for the intro, Dave. I'm Steve, host of All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes, a podcast documenting my ongoing mission to run or at least play all of the RPGs that I seem to be incapable of stopping myself buying.
And you'll see me frequently fiddling with something in my hands.
Each episode, I get together with a group of fellow gamers that have either played a game I've run or who've GM'd a game for me. We chat through what we've enjoyed about the game and some ways we could have improved the experience, whilst making a series of terrible jokes along the way.
Was it hot chat action?
Sometimes we con game designers who really should know better to come along and talk to us about their games, and maybe run an actual play segment to give us an idea of their vision for their game.
I've told this story before, it won't bore anyone.
Our topics range from old school favourites like RuneQuest through to some of those newfangled narrative games all the cool kids talk about. When you listen, I want you to feel as though you're sitting around our gaming table, taking part in our post-game chat and helping dispose of the last of the crisps and ale.
I'll just wax my bowstring and think about the death of the tainted.
Oh no, 898.
So, if you like listening to people droning on excitedly about games in a range of regional British accents, All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes is the pod for you, and you'll find it on your podcasting app of choice. On occasion, you may even hear something really insightful, but I'm making no promises. Over to you, Dave.
Point to Ponxes and make it a Titan.
Keep it eye.
There isn't another bit.
Thanks to Lawrence for appearing on the podcast and telling us about his game, and I'll put a link in the show notes so you can find out more. I should say that the week after going to UK Games Expo, I was at another convention, a microcon organised in Bradford called Rolling in the Ruins by our friends at Breakfast in the Ruins podcast. Like the podcast, it was a Moorcock-flavoured microcon where I played Corum and using the Stormbringer rules and had great fun, and it was great seeing everybody there. Fantastic weekend. Thanks, Andy. I know that I've been a bit tardy with the details of what's happening with Grogmeet in November, but please look out soon. It'll be on thegrognardfiles.com and you'll be able to see everything that's happening in Preston. I still need to sort out a few things, but it is going to go up there very soon after this episode drops, so look out for it. The best way to keep up to date is to join the Patreon, which you can do free now. But thank you to all the people who throw regular coins into the buoy to help keep this show on the road. I've got some new starters that have joined us recently, so I'll give them an individual shout out next time. Talking of next time, we're going to return to the subject of RPG magazines in the 1980s. Got a special guest joining us, and we'll be looking at those Thunder Page letters from 1983 sent by the Grog Squad. So it's not too late for you to submit yours. Send it to me at dirtthedice@gmail.com and we'll make sure that it gets covered. Remember, do it from the point of view of you writing it in 1983. I realise some of you may not have been born by then. Never mind, here we go. I feel really invigorated by gaming at the moment. I've had some great experiences playing face-to-face with friends, and I'm looking forward to the second half of the year doing more and more. So, until next time, adios, amigos. La, la.